Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is September 30, 1977, and this is my monthly audio letter number 26. Last month, after a silence of 3 months, I once again began recording the audio letter, and I told you that we are now entering a new phase, namely the fulfillment of the plans for economic collapse, dictatorship, and war about which I have been trying to warn you. I had hoped and prayed that this phase would never happen, that people would listen, would grasp the truth, and would do their duty under our representative form of government to stop our slide into catastrophe. But, my friends, it was not to be. Many millions of Americans are now familiar with many of the warnings I have relayed to you from my own intelligence sources, yet all but a few are blind to the reality of the danger. Their attitude is just to wait and see, not realizing that when they do see all these things, it will be too late to do anything. The entire United States Congress, too, is well aware of all my charges, but as usual they merely pass the buck, telling their worried constituents not to worry, that the Carter administration says there's nothing to it. And of course, they wouldn't lie. Meanwhile, the only real response that the government is now making to my charges is to try to silence the audio letter. At stake is not only the survival of the audio letter, but also the United States. I receive many letters these days from listeners who are concerned about bitter criticism leveled at me by various organizations and commentators. Invariably, my detractors proclaim themselves to be reliable, honest, and a source you can trust. Then they proceed to distort what they tell their readers, ridiculing my warnings and urging their readers to ignore me. One of the favorite tricks in this campaign against me is to refer to that old standby, that famous letter to me from General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, dated September 1, 1976. In this letter, General Brown stated in the present tense that he could find no evidence of the Soviet underwater missiles along our shores, whose locations I had given in audio letters number 14 and 15. And this statement was technically correct, my friends, since the United States Navy had just completed the process of removing all the Soviet missiles from our coastal waters the day before. Then the letter went on to open the door for direct contact between General Brown and myself. And as a result, on September 16, 1976, just over 2 weeks after the letter of September 1st, I met with General Brown in his Pentagon office for over an hour, without interruptions and without any time limitation. The purpose of that meeting was specifically to enable me to personally give General Brown 48 new locations of Soviet missiles in our waters so that General Brown could order them removed. Thus, General Brown wrote to me on September 1, 1976, and we met in his office over 2 weeks later, on September 16, 1976. But those who seek to mislead and betray their readers usually refer only to the letter. My meeting with General Brown usually is not mentioned, even though the fact we met is a matter of public record. Those who do acknowledge that there was a meeting neglect to mention when it took place, and thereby leave the reader with a false impression that the letter of September 1st ended the matter. This is only one example of the techniques that are being used to fool and confuse the unwary. I mention it only to alert you not to just swallow what you are told, but examine it with care. My friends, I cannot and I will not be distracted from the real battle by all of these falsehoods. Simply put, there are some who would have more faith in the Soviet Union than in what I am telling you. Only a miracle can save us now, my friends, and we as a nation do not deserve such a miracle. Nearly a year and a half ago in audio letter number 11 for April 1976, I revealed the growing fears of the trustees of the major Rockefeller-controlled foundations that the program for world domination had jumped the tracks. And, my friends, they could not have been more right. This month, September 1977, has witnessed the beginning of the end for the Rockefellers, and also for America as we know it. On the night of the harvest moon, September 27, 1977, the most decisive battle of the 20th century ended in a stunning upset. This battle, known only to a handful of individuals in the world, was the culmination of the great secret race in superweapons, which I revealed to you in audio letter 20 for January 1977. And, my friends, the Soviet Union won. Now the Soviet Union is mobilizing for war. Confident at last, the Rockefeller cartel can no longer stand in their way as they conquer the entire world. The four Rockefeller brothers, having set the world on its present disastrous course, can no longer do anything about what is about to happen. My three topics for today are: topic number one, war in space, the battle of the harvest moon, September 27, 1977. Topic number two, the last days of the Rockefeller Empire. And topic number three, the American dream in memoriam. Topic number one. 20 years ago, on October 4, 1957, the space age began with the launching of Sputnik 1 by the Soviet Union. Barely 3.5 years later, on May 25, 1961, President John F. Kennedy made the thrilling announcement that the United States was launching a program to put a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth before the end of the decade. Many Americans could hardly believe their ears. The Sputnik shock still had not worn off, and the Soviet space program was far ahead of our own. And for several years after the Kennedy announcement, the idea that we would beat the Russians to the moon looked more and more ridiculous. Americans ground their teeth in frustration as we watched the Soviet Union pile up one record after another in space. The first man in space, the first woman in space, the first spacewalk, records for time in orbit, and so on and on. But the Kennedy announcement in 1961 had signaled much more than a mere race with the Russians. It was a crash program, 10 times bigger than the Manhattan Project to develop the atom bomb in World War II. And gradually it began to pay off. The one-man space shots of Project Mercury gave way to the two-man missions of Project Gemini. And then, at last, Project Apollo with its three-man crews was underway. Finally, it was the Americans who were setting records in space, while the Russians seemingly began to lose heart. They busied themselves with orbital missions, but it became increasingly apparent that they would not soon put a man on the moon after all. On July 20, 1969, the impossible dream came true. After 8 years and $24 billion, the Apollo 11 landing craft made a perfect landing on the moon in the Sea of Tranquility. Neil Armstrong, as he placed man's first footprint on the moon, said those famous words, "That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind." The Soviet Union sulked at being beaten. Red China called the whole thing a hoax, but the rest of the world cheered. It was a great moment to be an American. For 3 years, America and the world watched as the exploits of the Apollo teams on the moon expanded at an astonishing pace. But then, strangely, The Apollo program was cut short to save money, we were told. After 6 successful moon landings, the last 3, potentially the most productive and spectacular of all, were unceremoniously lopped off, supposedly to save about 1% of the amount it had cost to reach the moon in the first place. After all, everyone knew we had gone to the moon merely as an exhilarating adventure and to pick up a few moon rocks for scientists to tinker around with. So having done that, we were told that it would be better to save those last few space dollars and put them into welfare checks or bullets for Vietnam. And so on December 19, 1972, the Apollo 17 crew lifted off from the Sea of Serenity, and America said farewell to the moon. That is what we were told, my friends, but that is not what happened. In AUDIO LETTER 19 for December 1976, I told you why America was not the first nation to orbit a space satellite, and now I can reveal the sequel, the true purpose and outcome of the race to the moon. America's space program has always been portrayed as a purely peaceful, scientific adventure without any ulterior motives. But, my friends, the Rockefellers never spend $24 billion, even if it's our own money, on anything that does not promise to reward them very handsomely. And these rewards, in the case of the space program, extend far beyond the great profits reaped by their aerospace companies. It is, or was until 3 days ago, the very keystone of their secret military machine for the conquest of the world. From the beginning, America's race to put a man on the moon had a military objective. The impetus for this race lay in a seemingly unrelated development, the laser, which was invented in 1960. The laser was a predictable outgrowth of an earlier American invention called the maser, invented in 1953, and therefore by the time the laser made its debut, it had been anticipated and military uses for it were under intensive study. The first hint of the things to come was a proposal by laser scientists in 1961. The same year that President Kennedy launched the crash program to put a man on the moon. The scientists suggested that lasers, which produced narrow, intense beams of light, could be used for interplanetary communication by flashing coded signals back and forth. What the scientists did not mention was that the destructive effect of extremely powerful lasers could also be projected for tremendous distances through space for space warfare. Worse yet, theoretical studies had already revealed that an even more awesome energy beam weapon was possible. This advanced weapon on the horizon was the terrifying particle beam, which was first brought to public attention early this year by General George Keegan, the freshly retired chief of the United States Air Force Intelligence. In a particle beam weapon, huge quantities of atoms are torn to shreds and fired out of the barrel at the target in a continuous concentrated beam that travels at almost the speed of light. The process requires fantastic amounts of energy, and the effect on any target is also fantastic. The very atoms that make up the target are torn to pieces by the beam, and the target explodes. With lasers and the particle beams looming as potential new military weapons, the moon suddenly became an inviting military objective. The moon is a 250,000 miles from Earth, and it takes several days for a spaceship to travel that distance, but it only takes about 1.5 seconds for radio signals or light to travel that far. Therefore, a moon base equipped with high-power lasers or particle beam weapons would be able to strike any visible spot on Earth within 2 seconds of pulling the trigger. And during any period of just over 24 hours, all or most of the populated areas of the Earth can be seen from the moon. The only exceptions are Arctic and Antarctic regions during parts of each month. And since a particle beam will bore right through clouds or storms to hit a target, a moon base will be an all-weather weapon. Finally, once it was in operation, this moon base would be virtually immune to attack by any less sophisticated weapon. For example, if a rocket were fired at the moon from Earth with a nuclear warhead to destroy the moon base, it would be useless. Long before it reached the moon, it could be destroyed by a blast of the particle beam. When the Rockefellers learned of the great potential of the moon for military purposes, the decision was made to launch a crash program to seize the moon for this purpose. The Soviet space program had been given a head start over that of America by means of Sputnik 1 disgrace, and under the hard driving direction of an engineer named Leonid Brezhnev, the Soviet lead in space was widening every day. But the Russian approach to exploiting space for military purposes was heavily oriented toward Earth orbital applications. Space stations would come first. After that, moon missions could be launched sometime in the future. For all the propaganda we heard about it at the time, a manned mission to the moon was not a top Soviet priority in 1961. But the Sputnik shock still had not worn off, and the Soviet space program was undeniably ahead of our own in 1961. So it was not very hard for the Rockefellers to convince America through their controlled major media that Russia was on its way to the moon and would beat us there if we did not do something. Having built up this public concern, the Rockefeller public relations machine then provided us with the solution to our worries. The space frontier was sold to us as exemplifying the bold spirit of President John F. Kennedy's so-called New Frontier. The dormant and suppressed American spirit of free adventure was tapped and channeled into enthusiastic, unquestioning support for the space program, even though we were never given anything more than the vaguest justifications for it. Thus a military project dwarfing the Manhattan Project was set in motion, in full public view, and drawing upon the very best talent and facilities that money could buy. Only the purpose of the Moon Project was kept a secret, and that secret was made secure by bathing the whole space program in the glare of continuous publicity. It was a clever plan, and it worked. By the time of the Apollo 17 mission in December 1972, the space program had become routine to many Americans, and they were looking around for other circuses to amuse themselves. And plenty of these were provided, including especially the budding Watergate scandal. Now space travel could safely be removed from public view and carried on secretly with far less danger of attracting attention than a decade before. Meanwhile, the Rockefellers, by way of their controlled CIA, had been working feverishly in total secrecy on beam weapons at locations outside the United States, such as a CIA-supported laser experiment installation in Spain. By 1972, these experiments still were a long way from a suitable weapon for deployment on the moon, but ominous developments in the Soviet Union led to the decision to cut off the Apollo program prematurely so that the construction of the secret moon base could be rushed ahead. Starting in 1967, the Soviet Union launched a massive program of its own to develop a particle beam weapon. This is what the Russians had started concentrating on instead of an immediate moon flight in the late 60s. Then in 1971, the Soviet civil defense program was stepped up, and on October 4, 1972, Soviet civil defense was elevated to a status equal to the armed services. Less than 3 months later, in December, Apollo 17 became the last American moon flight to be acknowledged publicly. The October 4, 1972 upgrading of Soviet civil defense initiated a high-priority 5-year plan which ends 4 days from now, the day after the expiration of the SALT I Accord. Under this plan, much of the Soviet Union has literally gone underground, complete with underground silos filled with American grain, and thousands of underground shelters able to withstand near misses of ICBMs. Strategic command centers and communications networks are underground now in the Soviet Union, and this was done not only to render any missile attack survivable, but also to provide some protection against any possible particle beam attack from the Moon. Early in 1973, soon after the supposed end of the American Moon program, we began hearing about a place called Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. Supposedly, we were merely building a communications installation there, yet the drastic step was taken of relocating all the 20,000 or so natives of this little island to other areas. More recently, we have heard about Diego Garcia as the site of a new American naval base, but, my friends, you still haven't been told the whole story. Diego Garcia, my friends, is the new spaceport from which secret missions to the Moon have been launched during the building of the Moon base. Unlike Cape Canaveral, where Saturn rocket launches are impossible to hide, Diego Garcia is remote and isolated, and even the natives are no longer there to watch what goes on. What's more, Diego Garcia is practically the perfect Moon port, located as it is almost on the Earth's equator, and a space vehicle launched eastward into orbit from Diego Garcia passes over a nearly unbroken expanse of water for more than half the circumference of the Earth. The only means of monitoring the early flight of a spacecraft launched from Diego Garcia, therefore, is from ships. If you have been unclear as to why Jimmy Carter has been talking so much about demilitarizing the Indian Ocean, which means Russia stay out, now you know. I was first alerted to the existence of a secret base on the Moon last November 1976, but it has been one of the best kept of all Rockefeller secrets, and it was only a few weeks ago that I was able to confirm its existence and learn the complete story. And since that time, events have moved with lightning speed. Throughout this year, an unseen but deadly race has been underway to see who would get an operational particle beam first, the Rockefellers at their secret Moon base or the Soviet Union in Earth orbit. By late spring, a Salyut manned spacecraft was launched that carried out preliminary tests of beam weapon techniques using lasers in order to simulate the particle beam. Then, on July 17, 1977, a large Soviet satellite called Cosmos 929 was launched. It has mystified satellite watchers because of its strange behavior in radio signals. Most observers have concluded that it is unmanned, having detected no verbal communications. But it is manned. It is a twin satellite consisting of a command module and a separate particle beam weapon module. All communications between the crew of Cosmos 929 and the Soviet tracking network are carried on by modulated laser beams, which cannot be detected at all by anyone who is not directly in the beam path. A particle beam is a fearsome weapon, and nearly 2 months of painstaking preparation and checkout of all systems preceded the first test. Meanwhile, American astronauts on the Moon worked at frenzied pace to try to bring their particle beam installation to operational status. By early September this month, the first particle beam unit on the Moon was being assembled. A few days later, the crew of Cosmos 929 tested their particle beam unit by firing it into open space to verify that it would function properly. It did. The next step was to test the beam against the target. The target chosen was an American spy satellite as it passed over the Petrozavodsk Observatory, which lies east of southern Finland. Cosmos 929 was nearly 1,000 miles to the south near the Black Sea. The local time was roughly 4 a.m. Tuesday, September 20, 1977, and the Moon was on the other side of the Earth. The crew of the Moon base were therefore unable to observe the test. Aided by computers, Cosmos 929 aimed and fired. The American satellite erupted into an immense fireball of light, which the Soviet news agency TASS described as a huge star which flashed out of a dark sky, sending shafts of light impulses to Earth. It took several minutes to dwindle to a red glow and burn out as it drifted eastward, and it was witnessed as far away as Helsinki, Finland, over 300 miles to the west. News reports that day in this country dismissed it all as a curious jellyfish-like UFO. 4 days later, September 24, the Soviet Navy, without explanation, expelled all British and French fishing trawlers, among others, from the Barents Sea. At the same time, Soviet trawlers in European Community waters were called home. By the 26th of September, American personnel at the secret Rockefeller Moon base, nestled in Copernicus Crater, were almost ready. Their particle beam was almost operational, but they were too late. By late that day, the Soviet Union began bombarding the Moon base with a neutron particle beam. Through the night and all day on September 27, the Moon base was bombarded without mercy with neutron radiation, just like that produced by a neutron bomb. And by that evening, as Americans looked up at the peaceful full moon overhead known as the Harvest Moon, the last few Americans on the Moon were dying of neutron radiation. America had lost the battle of the Harvest Moon. My friends, in 1945, America became the first nation on Earth to possess an awesome new superweapon, the atomic bomb. But now, it is the Soviet Union that has won the race for a new superweapon, the particle beam, that could be as decisive today as the atomic bomb was in 1945. The Rockefellers have disarmed America while betting everything on the Moon base, thinking they would win the race. But they made a terrible miscalculation, and now we will all suffer the consequences.